Sarah Sagar. She's currently Associate Professor in the Department of Health Services Policy and Management in the Arnold School of Public Health at the University of South Carolina. Her current research interests include health disparities, particularly colorectal cancer screening, physician leadership, provider behavior, and care outcomes in relation to health policy and environmental characteristics, and food defense. Sudha.
Thank you very much. And again, thanks everyone once again for being here at the end of a long day. I know many of you have walked practically from the convention center, and I don't know, it might have been your second walk from the convention center. Thank you. I'm presenting today, it's a nice segue from the earlier talk on the screening and screening acceptability and so on. This talk is regarding screening colonoscopies that was made available through a state program for indigent patients in South Carolina, and I'm presenting the evaluation of this program. I'd like to state that this is a collaboration between the State Department of Health and Environmental Control, the University of South Carolina, and the setting in which we actually got the grant, that is the Cancer Prevention and Control Program. None of us has any financial relationships to disclose. Thought we would start with a little, nice little thing from the American Cancer Society, which reminds us again that if we cross the age of 50, I need a colorectal exam. I hope none of us end up needing the other three. But colorectal cancer screening, it was very curious. I don't know if you all noticed when the previous session it was presented that there were, for breast cancer, there were 2:2, two doers and two non-doers, and or three doers and one non-doer. But in the case of colorectal, you saw that there were three non-doers and one doer group. Colorectal cancer screening is much less adhered to than the other one, and particularly screening colonoscopy, which is of course expensive. You have to meet your copays, deductibles, and also you must have insurance in order to do that, unlike breast cancer screening, which often has the support of the colorectal cancer network. Now, I really didn't know that this modality existed, this, bringing up one by one. Let me bring them all up and then. Okay. In South Carolina, we are having a high incidence of poverty compared to the national average. We have higher uninsurance rate. We have a high rural population with all the attendant access issues. And the most important thing is we have almost the highest proportion of African Americans who are also rural. So they do face a double disadvantage of being both African American and rural, which places them at a high risk of lack of access to any screening, and particularly the more expensive and the more specialist dependent or technology dependent screenings. A word about the colorectal cancer situation, particularly not only nationally but also in South Carolina. If you look at the lower, if you look at these, you will find that South Carolina has maybe slightly higher, it is possibly not statistically significant difference in terms of the incidence rates and the among them. But when you look at the racial disparities, you find that at the national level, men have about 17% higher incidence among African Americans compared to whites, and women 21% higher among African Americans. But when you look in South Carolina, it is definitely a whole lot more, almost double. Then look at the mortality differences. African American men have about 57% higher mortality from colorectal cancer compared to white men. And look at the number for women, look at the national average. So certainly there is a need to think of some ways to reach out colorectal cancer screening to the to the disparity population of African Americans. And at this point, I'd like to definitely draw one difference between colorectal cancer screening with colonoscopy as compared with any other, and that is this is the perhaps one of the few, with the exception of cervical cancer, one of the few so-called screening mechanisms that actually prevents the cancer in a primary way, because you remove the polyps before they become malignant. And secondly, this is one of the few cancers where the vast majority of cancers follow the sequence of starting first as a benign polyp and then getting converted into malignancy. So you have a good lead time in which to detect and remove the cancers. Of course, I'm aware that there has been lately some controversy regarding really how beneficial is colonoscopy screening in preventing colorectal cancer, or whether it is as beneficial as it's made out to be. But I think evidence is getting uncovered that it is the thoroughness and the high quality at which it should be done that will actually result in very high protection rates. But that apart, we come back to the topic of the Scope South Carolina trying to reach out colonoscopy services to the indigent population. Now, Scope South Carolina was a CDC-funded program which gave $1 million to the State of South Carolina Department of Health and Human Services. In order to reach out colonoscopy to indigent population. About 800,000 was set aside for the actual service. The rest of it was for the other data and the administrative management of the program. The program covered both outreach and providing the service. Again, you'll see later that that was an important part in order to get a high degree of completion rate of the procedure once people were contacted. Eligibility was, first of all, it was only for screening colonoscopy. It was not for surveillance colonoscopies for people who already had some polyps detected or who had a cancer in the past. The age was, as per the American Cancer Society recommendation, generally 50 to and beyond. They cut it off at 64 because of Medicaid kicking in later. And then the state of South Carolina particularly decided to relax or lower the age group for African Americans to 45 to 64 rather than 50 plus because of the quicker progression and the unusually higher incidence among this age group among African Americans. Income guideline criterion, less than 200% of federal poverty. And a very curious and important thing where all the beneficiaries who had to take advantage of this should have had a federally qualified health center as their medical home. And they had to be uninsured, or they should have had only hospital coverage and no outpatient service coverage. There were some unusual features of the South Carolina program that resulted in some degree of increased success. And that was, there was a budgeted effort for evidence-based patient navigation efforts. The second thing is they insisted that existing referral patterns should be followed, because the idea was that persons who are already in the system, in the primary care system, they should have first the chance to be navigated and assisted to make a decision about colonoscopy. The third thing was, in this program, they set up a medical quality assurance committee in order to oversee the clinical and pathology findings for every case, as and when the case details became available. They did it in real time so that any unusual outlier series could be caught and investigated why this is like this, and then corrected for that. So when we did the evaluation, the purpose, again, of our project was to evaluate this program. We wanted to evaluate from three perspectives. First of all, as a state program as a whole, how did it perform? What was the outreach? Did it manage to reach out well into different parts of the state? Did it reach the disparity population, the African American population? And what were the completion rates of the procedure after once a patient was approved and once a patient was motivated to perform, to get the procedure? The second set of parameters were the procedure performance. Was the procedure, clinical procedure, performed at a good level of quality? That is, what was the percentage where they achieved intubation right up to the level of the cecum, which is, as you know, where the colon ends. You have the diagram of the colon. You have to reach up to here in order to make say that it's complete. Then we have the outcomes. What were the outcomes in terms of finding lesions and in terms of potentially the number of cases that were avoided? So the immediate outcomes we looked at was what were the polyp detection rates. Now, if you have 100 patients and you did the procedure at a good level of quality, you expect a certain number of patients, percentage of patients for whom you found at least one polyp. What was the adenoma detection rate? As you know, or not all polyps are actually growths, new growths, but among them, if they are the adenomatous growths, still benign, but you want to get them out, so you want to get them removed. So you want the adenoma detection rate to be good so that your performer, the clinician who did the colonoscopy, is doing a good job. They wanted to evaluate that, or they got the data on that and we wanted to evaluate. The next step is the imminent, the growths that are imminently in danger of becoming cancer, that is the advanced neoplasia detection rate. What percentage of patients had an advanced neoplasm detected? And then next, the mean adenomas per subject screened. That is, it's not enough if you just find one and get out, but you want to be sure you have cleared out the colon of all possible adenomas that they have. So the thoroughness with which it was cleared, that is the mean adenomas per subject screen and mean advanced neoplasms per subject screen. So we wanted to look at these, whether these met the U.S. Quality benchmark set up by the multi-society task force. Now, a quick run-through of the results. The patients and physicians, how many were covered, what were their demographics? So a total of 32 physicians in three regions of the state, the upstate, Midlands, and Lowcountry, completed the procedures. They had 665 procedures that were completed and funded under the program. However, there was one aspect where we found that the program reached more females than males. So males still were lagging. However, the good thing that you find here is 71% of the persons who received the procedures were African American. So the program did reach out well to the disparity population. And interestingly and importantly, which you will see later, about 11%, almost 12% were 45 to 49-year-old African Americans. No whites were 45 to 49. All of them were African Americans. Let's look at the general, from a public health general perspective and comparing them with the national benchmarks. First of all, the targeted number of screenings with the amount of money they had was 782. And they actually identified, because they were through FQHCs, these number of people were identified through FQHCs among the established patients of those qualified health centers without insurance and qualifying to the other criteria. Where is my, okay. The screenings done were 665, and that gives you an 85% completion of those who were actually identified, which is very high because you generally see that the loss between identifying and motivating a person to undergo screening colonoscopy and them actually completion tends to be quite high. The best program that so far documented is 66% completion with a very quite a elaborate patient navigation program. And again, this speaks to the importance of maintaining the same referral patterns. The cecum intubation rate exceeded the national benchmark. Bowel preparation rate was 92.1% of fair to excellent. And that is an important indicator because the poorer the bowel preparation, it's more likely that some polyps will be hiding behind some of the residue and not be able to be cleared out from the colon. So that's an important indicator, and it was not bad. Polyps completely removed, that is 93.1%, which meets the national benchmark. Sometimes you may have to leave behind parts of the polyp, either due to lack of skill of the performer or due to, you know, local biomedical issues. Then precancerous and cancer detection rates, what were they? The percent of persons who had at least one hyperplastic polyps, which lately have become also important, 34.6% of those who underwent this procedure had at least one hyperplastic polyp removed. The adenomas rate was quite high. Remember that this was a female-dominated population. Female national benchmark is 15%. Male is 25% to have an adenoma removed, and when you look at this group, was you know, good at 27.8%, even though it was males plus females. Total number of adenomas removed were 338. Percent of screened persons with an advanced neoplasm, that is, you know, imminent, we think that they are imminent towards advancing towards cancer, that is 8.6%, nearly 10% had one removed. And the total number of advanced neoplasm lesions that were removed were 68. By the way, advanced neoplasms are defined as polyps which are 1 centimeter or more in size, have villous features, indicating finger-like protrusions, which would indicate a more rapidly growing growth, or having advanced dysplasia, or, you know, what do you call chaotic cellular multiplication features when you examine by microscopy. So those are all called advanced neoplasms. So all of them are considered risk factors for imminent change. And based on a lifetime risk of all Americans developing, of 5% of all Americans developing colorectal cancer sometime during their lifetime, and looking at the percentage of colon cancers, colon and rectum cancers that follow the polyp sequence, and the timeline for them, the sojourn rate to become cancer, and assuming a cancer protection rate of 70%, the estimate was that about 23 cases were prevented. Now, the important take-home finding that we found was, you know, please let me know if I'm running time and stuff. Okay. The important take-home thing that we found, which was very surprising to us, was that the 45 to 49-year-olds had the same number of mean number of adenomas per subject screened as the older age groups. There was no difference among the younger versus older age groups. So the younger African-Americans, this seems to suggest, I mean, it's true that this is only a 665, you know, sample, of which about 68 or 70 were of that 45 to 49 age group, but it was still not good to find that, which may suggest that a little more, maybe a larger study of this age group, and then, you know, considering about the guidelines and considering about insurers to cover the procedures at a younger age group. Mean advanced neoplasia. So we said, well, maybe they have adenomas. Okay, let them wait for five more years and let's get it out. But then you see that the mean number of advanced neoplasms no different among the 45 to 49 versus 60 to 64. So this was another important new finding that we had. Mean number of adenomas by race, again, no difference. This was statistically not significant. Were so small, even though they are less, the number was extremely small, the number of subjects. And similarly, look at the advanced mean neoplasms per subject. It was similar by race. Oh, what happened? Okay. Okay, let's look at what was the outcomes of the SCOPE South Carolina program. What did we achieve by doing this evaluation? First, and what did we find that this program achieved? The first thing it did was it had important public health outcomes. The important public health outcome was it definitely reached a high disparity population. 71% were African Americans. It does save, or we think it is going to save, millions of dollars in cancer treatment and lost productivity due to early detection. There had two cases that were detected cancer cases in this 665 group, and the estimated 23 cases that were prevented. It reached out screening to indigent population, which is the FQHC population, and it saved more life years than conventional programs, because the younger African Americans were screened, unlike almost all other programs which target or cover by paying only for the 50 plus age group. What were the research contributions? Small as this cohort is, it did give some important new knowledge was generated. The first thing is that it did validate our earlier study of the high quality and effectiveness of specialist-backed PCP performed colonoscopies. Now, in this group of 665 colonoscopies, about a third of them were performed at a center which gets primary care docs to perform colonoscopies under a very rigorous colonoscopy protocol and with a specialist available on call all the time, plus some technical protocol compensations that they have in order to ensure that quality does not suffer with the PCP performing colonoscopy. The gain or the bang for the buck in that particular model is that the PCPs bring their own patients to the center and then perform it. And a good number of them are African American physicians who we found from another study that among their patient panels, once they got trained in colonoscopy, the colonoscopy screening compliance increased remarkably. It increased fivefold among their African American patients as compared with, we do not know why, stagnant rates among their white patients. We have yet to do another study of the trained white physicians in colonoscopies to see what happened among their panels with regard to the race concordance issue. We do not know whether that exists. Anyway, for better or worse, one of the things that this did for us, our earlier study of quality and effectiveness by any measure was published in Medical Care last year in March. It was, quality and effectiveness of PCP colonoscopies by, me and co-authors. And the second thing, research contribution of this SCOPE program cohort, was that it showed that younger African Americans have as much risk of adenomas and advanced adenomas as the traditionally age-eligible screening population, which we consider more than 50 years. I think this is an important finding. And lastly, we just wanted to put up with all our partners and with the, some nice graphics about colonoscopy. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, so now we'd like to open it up to questions. Anyone have questions for our presenters? Yes. Then speak up, please, so that everybody can hear.
Thank you, everyone, first of all. And I have a few questions kind of all over the board for Sarah Connor. What was the decision on the large age range? I think you said 20 to 65.
So it was a matter of the men who were recruited and who their first degree relatives were.
Okay. And, that's what I wondered on the earlier end, the younger men, 20 to 40 or something, were they relative to people who had prostate cancer or just relative to the people with
So then the first thing, the men with prostate cancer were recruited in the IMPACT program. So this is generally a much younger population being diagnosed with prostate cancer. The average age in the program is 60. So they actually do have college age children. Mm-hmm. And so these were their sons. The older men tended to be brothers and not sons. So the younger group tended to be more
This was a program which was following routine referral. The money came to the South Carolina Department of Health and Environmental Control. The department set up the medical care quality assurance. Monies were dispersed directly to the providers according to the number of colonoscopies that they performed and submitted the billing information. Now, the standards that were expected to be followed was that if a person is found to have an adenoma, depending on the characteristics of the adenoma and depending on the age of the person, family history, there are guidelines for subsequent surveillance, and those are generally followed by the practitioners. This is completely community-based performance of colonoscopy. It's not a clinical trial or anything like that. It's a programmed performance, and we assume, at least we know that one of the centers which we are very familiar with, which incidentally, as I said, it validated that center's performance. Now that center we know observes, follows the guidelines with regard to future surveillance, and we have no reason to believe that any of the others would not do so.
Yes?
For the last presenter, kind of follow up on your question, though you followed guidelines, was there funding for the patients to receive the follow-up colonoscopies if necessary? Or, because these are patients through federally qualified health centers, so was it up to the provider of how that would be paid for?
Well, that is a very good question. As you know, if the person does not have cancer, then the remaining, follow-up colonoscopies don't become due for anything earlier than 2 years, maybe maximum 1 year, 2 years. As far as we know, we believe that some mechanism would be found later. There is no established way under the current scope. In fact, scope closed down, as you know, everywhere budgets have gone downhill. After that first million, no more money was forthcoming on that. But the two cancer cases that were detected, they were followed up, and arrangements were made for them to be treated to be covered. But unlike the Best Chance Network, where Medicaid is obligated to cover the women detected to have breast cancer under the thing, this one does not have. And in fact, that was one of the concerns of the state health department. Now, what do we do after we find the cases? It's fine that they found just two cases and they were able to depend on the goodwill of some of the providers to take them under their wing and get things going. They were going to get them qualified for Medicaid and take care of the subsequent steps. But otherwise, that was one of the reasons why they have sort of pulled back on being too much advocacy, for the program.
I have one more question, if that's all right.
Sure.
Also for you. So there was an actual recruitment.
Could you please stand so she can see you? Because she really can't see you through the computer.
There wasn't actually recruitment out in the community to bring patients in. These were patients who were already being seen in federally qualified health centers, and the practitioner basically just identified patients who needed a colonoscopy. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Okay.
They set up one person to be a patient navigator in each federally qualified health center to identify who are the patients who are age eligible and not had a colonoscopy before, and then they took it from there to ensure that the provider talked to them about colorectal cancer and navigated them until they got the referral and subsequent instructions from the performer.
Yes.
I have a question for you about how did you assess the knowledge of the men on prostate cancers? The prevention, did you use existing instruments or?
No, it was a qualitative interview, so we used a semi-structured interview guide, and it just was a matter of asking them those questions and probing for what their knowledge was.
Yes.
I have a question for Dr. Johnson. Once you found that there was variation in the surveillance strategies, and there were physicians or clinicians that did not adhere to the ASCO guidelines, what's the next step now? What's ASCO going to do with this, or what is VA going to do? The next steps based on that.
We have no plans for any further steps. treatment community, patient advocacy groups, groups like the APHA, to lobby the funding agencies to do these trials. They're all long-term trials because it takes years to accumulate enough people to make to adequately power a trial. It takes several years to follow up what the ultimate survival data show, and that all takes a lot of money. But NIH does not currently fund trials dealing with surveillance after curatively treated patients have been treated. So we don't have any plans to do more than that. That's sort of occupied much of my adult life, trying to determine the ways that people follow patients after curative intent cancer treatment.
That's good to know.
Well, I think you're being a little modest. You've got a whole book. You're getting ready to put out another book.
Yes. That takes a lot of my effort, too.
How often should one have a colonoscopy?
The normal interval, if the colonoscopy was screened normal, that means you didn't remove any adenomas, is 10 years. They're 10 years,
okay.
Every 10 years. And if the adenomas that were removed were small and their histology was basically adenomas, tubular adenomas, and they were small, then it is still 10 years. But if it had certain dysplastic features, then combined with the family history, there are combinations, then the duration gets lower and lower. Now, if the more chaotic the cellular multiplication features in the microscopy, surveillance period can go as little as 2 years or 3 years. Sometimes, if the person felt like they did not fully remove the adenoma because it was, you know, sort of penetrating inside, or even though the histology showed that it was not yet malignant, but they didn't feel like they removed the whole thing, but it was dysplastic, then they may even go for 1 year. It's some of these, when it gets to that very borderline kind of cases, it definitely becomes very much the judgment of the clinician, you know, who has to underwrite the risk of the patient. And, you know, when you have that responsibility, that they go by their gut feeling or by what they feel they need to do in order to safeguard the interest of the patient. But otherwise, if you have those very clear, you know, if a person falls into those very clear groups, no family history or only one person in the family and or a distant relative and so on, no, just a tubular adenoma, small, no problem, they were removed, and hopefully all of them were removed if it was done with a good level of quality, and if that was done, then 10 years.
There's a question in the back, yes.
Also in regards to the South Carolina colorectal screening program, could you speak a little bit more about the patient navigation piece? Were the navigators hired by the program? Were they hired by the individual SQHC? Did they receive training?
Right.
Did they get a full-time job?
I believe they were part-time navigators, and they were, or actually in most cases, they were existing staff of the SQHC who were given this responsibility for the duration of the program, and they had a clear guideline. I think I will let Daniela Friedman is also from the is from our the cancer prevention and control program, but I'm not so clear about exactly what were the guidelines for navigation that were given. But mainly it had to do with patient with you know motivation, barriers, facilitators, discussion, talking the patient through about it. Through with it, and then giving them clear instructions, you know, about the nature of PrEP, what is going to happen to you, who is going to drive you back, okay, helping to make some of those arrangements, basically trying to, you know, set aside the barriers and facilitators, and in some cases asking the doctor to talk to them again if they were a little on the fence about getting it done. So various activities, and my understanding is at least a couple of the federally qualified health centers had the standard patient navigation, you know, guidelines protocol that exists about it. I am not much into that field, but I believe that's the case.
I don't know if they were full-time staff or nurse navigators.
But they were actually employees of the center who were.
So when the money ran out, then that was just it. These people are just, I mean, wow.
Well,
they were already staff of the center. They went back to doing whatever job they did. They had this as
not,
an.
Not the people.
The patients.
Right.
Yeah,
the majority of the patients, as you know, would become eligible for a colonoscopy after 10 years. And we hope that something will come about and they will be able to still get their colonoscopy after 10 years.
Then their finances, or they don't have their copay, and those individuals still won't be seen. This is in Orangeburg, South Carolina, right?
This is the entire South Carolina, that is upstate. The Midlands includes Orangeburg and the Lowcountry.
Charleston and Lowcountry.
Yeah. And to some extent, the fact that you have a 10-year period helps. And the fact that it is true, the persons who had, 10% of them had an advanced adenoma. So they will become eligible for colonoscopy within the next 2 years, 3 years, 5 years. That is something that each FQHC doctor will start working through, what is the next way that we are going to fight it in some other forum and just, claw out the money to get it done.
Right.
FQHCs, I think all the time they are struggling and making things happen, and we assume that's what's going
to
happen.
Well, I think by 2014 the Affordable Care Act is supposed to go into, is supposed to go into action.
Yeah.
Everybody is supposed to have medical insurance.
NAC is in the expo, the National Association of Community Health Centers, and they have current data about who's going to their centers, number of centers, that kind of thing. So if for more information about that, I'd suggest if you can find them in the expo. I can't remember exactly where they were in that large room, but they have the latest data on a lot of these questions that people are asking.
That's good. Do we have any other questions?
I just wanted to add one follow-up to that. Are the health centers that you worked with now instead focusing on FOBT or stool quite testing as an alternative screening modality?
In general, we know that the FQHCs are falling back on FOBT as the alternative to the extent that they can. And there have been several studies showing that while people say that a good proportion of the FQHC patient population is sort of up to date, there's a substantial proportion, but most of that tends to be with FOBT, which is not a very happy thing to be using as a screening tool, because FOBT is only 28% sensitive to find adenomas. Even when you combine it with the FIT, which is called the fecal immunochemical test, that has advantage of being more specific but not necessarily more sensitive. By the time you want to make it more sensitive, you also lose your specificity, so you will have many more routed into the colonoscopy road. So it's like, whichever way you balance it, FOBT, the sensitivity is very low when you do it at the full level of rigor. That is, three times during the year, three successive, and each time two samples of the stool being captured. And the statistics show that only about a third of them do it correctly and not do it by an office-based, fecal examination, office-based finger examination fecal sample. So when you combine all of that and multiply, you would find that the FOBT is about, when you multiply 0.28 times again another 0.28, you find that the actual effectiveness of FOBT is something like 8 or 9% in catching adenomas. I don't think we want to be in those other 92%. None of us want to be there. So you just have it.
Okay, we're about out of time. I know May had a question.
Yes,
I think a couple of quick clarification questions. You reported that almost 20% of your responses were not evaluable. What was going on with that? Was the task difficult for the doctors?
No, I think they were incomplete. They didn't fill out all boxes. take my word for it. Those that have sent surveys, many of the recipients are not very happy to receive them.
Yes, that's right. For the people who receive the colonoscopies younger than 50,
mm-hmm.
were they people who had family history? Why were they selected to receive those colonoscopies? Is it surprising if they had family history that you find all that you found?
We have no reason to think that they were hyper-selected. All the program said, that the SCOPE program said was, if they are 45 to 49 and African-American, never had a screening colonoscopy before, they are eligible, they qualify for this program.
Oh, I see. Okay.
If they had extra family history, we don't know. Actually, that data is there, but you know, it was a little messed up, and we didn't have the time to kind of tease that out at the time, but sooner or later, we are going to tease it out.
Okay, I'd like to once again thank all of our presenters. Hope you'll join me. And I also once again want to thank the Cancer Forum, because it was actually their idea for the two groups to collaborate on this session. I think it came together quite well, so I hope we do more of this going forward. So, thank you.